Thank you for tuning in to Hacks and Hobbies with your host, Junaid. We're visited by our amazing guests coming from all walks of life. We want to learn their story, their struggles, and their journey on how they got to where they are today. So stick around. Welcome back to another episode here on Hacks and Hobbies. Now, every entrepreneur dreams about scaling, but let's be honest. Raising capital can be one of those most overwhelming, frustrating, and even risky parts of the journey. And today, I've got an amazing human being here, Michael Haskell, who's been an entrepreneur with over 20 years of experience helping businesses grow smarter and faster. He's taken companies public, built teams across New Zealand, Singapore, and the US, and now runs Navitas Consulting, helping companies scale by placing top finance talent remotely and cost-effectively. By the end of this episode, you'll know the key principles to raising capital with confidence. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Junaid. I appreciate you having me.
Absolutely, Michael. I love that you've worked in so many different parts of the world, right? Funny enough, I was just having a conversation about how cultural differences shape business practices. I myself, grew up in, I was born in Pakistan, grew up in Saudi Arabia, then came to the US in my 20s. And it's so important to understand the different cultures and different things because it helps you adapt so much better. So talk to me. I'm really curious. We were talking in the green room on when you moved out of the States. And I want to know, what did you learn early in your career about adapting across regions?
Right. Okay. So I left the United States. I grew up on the East Coast, in Annapolis, Maryland. Initially left after my college time in 2005 to come out to Asia Pacific and have an initial investigation. Because back then I was of the view that Asia Pacific was going to have a big next 5 or 10 years. I thought it might be a good region where it would be beneficial, commercially beneficial to be involved. I took a look at Australia and New Zealand. Back then I didn't yet have the confidence to live in a country where English wasn't the first language, right? It was the first time I was going to live outside of the US.
Yeah.
So I settled on New Zealand and I went back after my 2005 trip. Got everything in a row, sold my condo, liquidated as much as I could and got ready to move to the other side of the world and then moved to New Zealand in 2007.
Nice.
And then I was there for the first, 6 or 7 years of my time in Asia Pacific. And then I went over and lived in Australia for a while.
Yeah.
And then after that came up to Singapore for a bit as well. Understanding the different cultures and the different values and the different approaches to work is massive, and it takes some learning, right? Coming from the U.S. Coming from the East Coast of the United States, when I first got to New Zealand, I would have expected the pace of business to be the same, and I was completely wrong.
Yeah.
In New Zealand, it's not really island time. I mean, it's not slow.
Yeah.
But it's not East Coast U.S. pace either, right?
Right. Yeah.
It's a bit in between, and when you first get there, you have to kind of settle in and figure that out. Once you do realize what places are good for what things, though, it almost ends up when you start thinking about building a business or resourcing a business, it's almost like making a restaurant decision, right? You think, wherever you might be, you think, well, I'd really like a cheesesteak. Well, you're not gonna go into the seafood restaurant looking for the cheesesteak.
Right.
When you realize, once you've lived in enough countries, you're like, well, listing's really good over there. Raising capital's really good over there.
Yeah.
Outsourcing my finance team's really good over there.
Yeah.
Right. Getting my artwork done's really good over there. You begin to look at it almost like you would think about where you want to go to lunch in your home city.
Yeah. That's really powerful, Michael, because you're absolutely right. In the US, we can almost find everything at literally every restaurant because people go, but it makes it a lot of sense. You wouldn't expect different cuisine at a specific restaurant because they're really focused, they're really niched down, if I were to use that word again. So let's dive in a little bit. Let's get right into it about raising capital. When an entrepreneur is thinking about raising capital, where should they first start?
Okay, so when an entrepreneur first wants to raise capital, for me, I guess it really depends on if that's at the idea stage,
mm-hmm.
or if you have a business where you've proven, you've recognized some revenue, and you're beginning to scale to capture some additional market. If you're at the seed stage, I usually recommend trying to tap friends and family or bootstrapping.
Yeah.
Because it's not impossible to raise at the seed stage with professional investors and still keep the majority or strong majority of your business. But with a lot of professional investors, if they're going to take a substantial risk on your business at the idea, you know, ideation stage, they're going to expect, you know, material, substantial upside.
Hmm.
So for the entrepreneurs that I get involved with, I do try to recommend that if they're at the idea stage, they try to bootstrap, or they look to friends and family, or they, you know, they look to other local kind of friendly, potentially angel investor networks. If you've got, you know, a semi-retired professional that is happy to come in for, you know, 50, 100, 150, that kind of level investment that can help you prove,
yeah,
you know, the market that you're looking to capture. Now, once you get past that point, it really depends on what you want to do with the business, right? So once you've got your business and you are scaling rapidly, let's say, you know, you're double or tripling revenue on an annual basis. And let's say you're really fiscally responsible. So you're operating in the black, right? You're not burning cash, but you're tripling up revenue every year. You know, okay, you're in a really good spot at that point. You could look for some venture capital space. You could also go out and just look for a network of high net worth individuals, right? That depending upon where in the world you are, you know, usually one of your brokers can get you put in contact with some of their higher net worth clients that do like to take a look at early stage stuff. So you don't necessarily need to jump right in with VC because VC usually wants a substantial chunk.
Yeah, they do.
And they're going to want to push you really hard to continue to triple up revenue for the next 2, 3, 4, 5 years. And I think a lot of entrepreneurs that have had that, I'm actually in a project right now that took VC investment about 6 months ago. Mm-hmm. And I'm a director and investor, and I'm close with the CEO founder.
Yeah.
And I know that he's had some sleepless nights because the VC money is, it seems like it never sleeps, and they always want you to do more. So, you know, it really depends on where you are in your evolution of the business. All of that being said, I think you want investors that can add value to your project above and beyond everything else, right? So whether you're looking at friend and family round, hopefully you have friends or family that have some of the skills. Maybe they've had some accounting or some legal expertise. They've got some skills that they'd be willing to contribute to you at free or at least well below market value.
No, you're absolutely right. When you bring in friends and family, they feel you know, belongingness as well. I'm like, oh my God, this guy's starting something brand new. They've asked me to join in, jump in. And that also goes to, you know, deeper into why there are so many more family businesses than there are investor backed. But again, it all comes down to how much work and how much real effort goes into all of that. Now, as somebody's thinking of starting something brand new, you know, the example I share about GoBox Studio, we bootstrap, right? We bootstrap, we put in our money, research and development. But now that we're thinking of, okay, we want to do maybe a Kickstarter campaign, maybe raise money from the crowd because, you know, it's a creator-led product. But you're mentioning, hey, no, you go to friends and family if you can't bootstrap. Now that we've covered that, what are some of the top three things investors are looking for before they even consider writing a check? Because these are things that I'm sure friends and families are also probably thinking about. So let's jump into that.
Okay, so for me personally, when I do investing in entrepreneurs, I'm looking for integrity. And if at all possible, I'm looking for a track record. And that track record doesn't have to be, look, man, I've had a deck a million exit or better, right? It doesn't have to, but it does have to look a lot like, I've had my head down working really, really hard on my business. I don't, I can persist. I can surmount adversity, those sorts of things, right? So it's character and integrity, first and foremost. Then for me, I'm looking at growth rate and then how we're going to be able to value your business when we take it to, say, the next level of investment beyond me, right? So if I would say come in somewhere between kind of seed and Series A, right? It's like, okay, how will we be able to position this business for that next level investor that maybe is coming in at Series A that maybe is a more traditional VC outfit? And will this business hit their metrics, or are we looking at building this together for the next 5 or 8 years, and then we're going to look at listing it on a share market, or are we looking at building it for the next 4 or 5 years, and then we're going to look at a private equity exit? So a lot of what I look for in the business depends on what the founder or the team of founders want to do with their business. And if I think what they want to do with their business kind of stacks up to what I think is achievable, right? If you're, if you've got an old economy business, and there are fantastic old economy businesses, right? You've got laundromats, whatever you're doing. Great cash flow, exceptional cash flow businesses, very economically resilient, right? There's a lot of good things to like about laundry mat businesses, but they're not going to get 12 times earnings. Or sorry, they're not going to get 12 times revenue. So it all depends on kind of where the founding team is looking to go.
That's really powerful. Getting the understanding. I love that you say, where's the founding team looking to go? Because they've defined their why, they're defined their goalpost kind of thing. Hey, this is where we want to go, and this is the amount of time, and this is how much work we're putting in. So as an investor, you're like, oh my God, they've done all the work. I don't even really need to think about it. All they need is a little bit of fuel. It's almost like you're going to the gas station, you're gonna get enough gas. You're not gonna get enough gas just to get to the next stop. You're gonna get, you're gonna fill up that tank, and that's what investors or that's what founders are looking for. Hey, we just need gas to get to this next point, and we can do it with this one, and then after that, we can self-support.
Yeah, and if that investor can add a little bit of know-how and expertise too, that's the cherry on top, right? But yeah, if you can find founding teams that have a reasonable view of where they want to go, recognizing that an overall vision, we're going to pivot a lot, right? So it's not a direct roadmap, right? It's a broader vision, timeline, the amount of investment that we're going to need in order to kind of get to these outcomes that we're targeting. If they know those things in advance, it makes them a lot easier to invest in, no doubt.
Amen. Amen. Now, Michael, if someone's listening and is at the 1 million to 5 million stage, what's the difference for them compared to someone aiming to go public?
So if they're looking to raise 1 to 5 rather than going public, okay. So they're looking to raise 1 to 5. They can be incredibly selective over who, and of course, they've got a good business, right? Assuming they've got a good business, they can be incredibly selective over who they bring on board, which puts them in a great position. I mean, once you list who's on your share register is up to the market, right? I mean, you don't have much control at all over that. So if you're looking in the 1 to 5 space, you can kind of cherry pick, who you want to get involved based on what skills you need, what expertise you need, and where you want to go next, right? So you're really in a really nice position. And it's a good model or a good, I guess, pathway to go ahead and hit certain milestones rather than trying to jump from, three or four founders and a team of 50 up to an IPO, right? It does make sense to bring on board an initial external investment raise in that 1 to 5 or 1 to 3, and maybe even another one, because you're learning so much at each stop along the way, each truck stop, so to speak, along that pathway. I mean, but if it's a good business and that's what they want to raise, they can really go out and look for the skills they want in order to support them for going to the next stop.
I love that. I love that. And that's what we see a lot at on shows like Shark Tank or, you know, Dragon's Den. The company is already working. They're looking for a mentor, a coach, and investment. And, you know, you're what you're sharing is absolutely gold, because it's not just theory. They're looking for that real world experience as well as the cash flow. Now, before we wrap this first conversation, let's put out some actionable hacks. So what's the one thing every entrepreneur should be doing right now to prepare for raising capital, even if they're not ready to raise yet?
Okay, so to prepare for raising capital, you should, your business hygiene should be in good shape all the way along. Like, and I recommend having external audits done on an annual basis, even if you're not planning on raising cash that year, because I'll tell you what tends to happen. If you go to an auditor and say, hey, look, you know, I'm getting ready to do an investment round. I'd like to have my last couple of years of financials looked at. Obviously, they see big dollar signs because they figure you're under pressure to get an audit done quickly so that you can raise cash. So you're no longer a market maker at that point when it comes to your relationship with the auditor. You're a taker. But if you keep your business hygiene rock solid all the way along your pathway, you know, when the opportunity presents itself, or when your growth aspirations kind of demand some additional funding, you're already in a good position to do that. So for the when I get involved, that's one of the first things I try to do. So depending upon what accounting standards they're using, I try to get them shifted over to international financial reporting standards, so basically a GAAP reporting, which is, for the most part, each country has a slight variance, but it's mostly the same across the planet. Nice. And for the reason that you want the numbers to be presented in a way that an investor from Singapore and an investor from California are both going to understand your numbers, right? So I try to get them encouraged to do that straight away. And then usually within that first 6 to 9 months of my investment, I'll help them go out and do a competitive tender to find an audit partner, and usually kind of get those books audited as well, so that when the time is right, you know, you never want to be as the entrepreneur or the team of founders, you never want to be sitting there, oh my goodness, in 2 months' time, we're going to run out of money if we don't go out and raise. But we are not in any way, shape or form prepared to raise. I mean, you're in most instances, if you go about it that way, you'll probably fail. But even if you're successful, and I wish those guys all the success possible, but even if you are successful, you're going to pay significant premiums for getting gatekeepers, so to speak, along the way to kind of sign off quickly. So you're better off to have your ducks in a row early on.
I love that, Michael. Next up, what's one habit or mindset shift that helped you personally when dealing with investors and high-pressure financial decisions?
So patience is incredibly important. I'd say a combination of patience and resilience, right? Because it happens regularly that you think a potential investor that you've had a couple of conversations with, maybe a lunch with, you think this investor is probably 95% there, and they're gonna give you what your ask is without asking for any concessions, without asking for any favorable terms, right? You're like, yeah, you know what? These guys are good. This is gonna be no problem. And then in the 11th hour, all of a sudden, there's a bunch of, you know, favorable terms that they want that advantage them and disadvantage any of your other shareholders.
Exactly.
And if you're a good chief executive, or if you're a good founding team, you have to tell them at that point basically to hit the bricks. Even if you don't want them to, they at least have to know that's a non-negotiable for you, right? So they have to feel like you're prepared to walk. So, you know, a little bit of patience and then an element of resilience too, because there are going to be, I mean, your business is not going to be the right fit for a ton of investors, and especially depending upon where we are in the economic cycle. I mean, if we look back at the last 20 years, there have been times that, you know, you get a couple of million bucks for a popsicle stand because you've got a really cool, you know, lemon sickle flavor, right? And then there have been times that even with like really nifty tech, it's hard to find takers. So, you know, patience and then the resilience to kind of continue to push through. Equal measures of both.
I love it because patience is the number one thing that every single person, I think, should have, because when you have that patience, then you're able to, you know, not do reactively. You're more proactive on doing things. And resilience, you know, keeping in the grind and keeping in that fate, you know, I just got to keep working harder, find the right deals, and boom, it all pays off at the end. Thank you so much, Michael. Let's jump into some really fun questions. Now, you mentioned golf, okay, right? When I asked about, you know, your hobby that you wanted to learn, what lessons has golf taught you that apply to business?
Well, golf is fantastic for patience, no doubt about that.
Yes, it is.
The other big one with golf, you know, sometimes it's better to be lucky than good. You know, there is an element, you know, give me the guy that practices every day and works hard every day. It's more likely that he is going to have a more successful career or a more successful golf outing. But every now and again, you know, there is an element of you just happen to be in the right place at the right time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that shouldn't ever undo your hard work.
Yes.
But if you can, try to get yourself in the right place at the right time too.
And like you said, you know, the more time, the more practice you do at something, guess what? You're going to find yourself to be in the right place at the right time because you're constantly showing up in the places.
Yeah.
Now, a book that you're reading, Reagan's biography, what leadership lessons from that book stands out most for you?
Ooh, okay. So there are quite a few. I mean, I'm a bit of a Reagan fan.
Yeah.
Obviously, not to get too political, but I think he was very successful in certain areas. Mm-hmm. I think his foreign policy was very good. I think his ability to speak directly and firmly was really, really good, especially in dealing with the former Soviet Union at that time. The, hey, look, you know, this is what is acceptable for us and this isn't, you know, again, that's got similarities to dealing with VCs when you're when you're the board of directors of the startup or you're the founding team. You know, guys, look, we'd love to have you involved. We really would. And we mean that wholeheartedly. However, we're not going to bend over a barrel, right? So, I mean, that's where we are. And being able to combine that kind of straight talk with firm boundaries, I think it's important. And I think a lot of, even myself, probably 10 or 15 years ago as a younger entrepreneur, I would not yet have figured out how important firm boundaries are, right? You know, okay, wait, you want to have a put option on your shares, or you want to have another trigger event where you could go ahead and buy more shares, but the other shareholders can't. Yeah, no, sorry. I mean, we're going to treat all shareholders the same way and being firm about that. Because if you don't, a lot of VCs are very skilled at, you know, extracting preferential treatment.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, Reagan's leadership can apply to how you would engage with raising capital too.
I love it, Michael. Thank you so much for breaking this down so clearly. You know, raising capital is one of the hardest thing for people to think about because most entrepreneurs have either worked at a full-time job where they didn't have to think about raising the capital. They're given tasks and you're into doing the thing. And people who are running businesses, they've had other mentors or, you know, maybe their family was entrepreneurs. And, you know, so it's really good that you help us break this down so clearly. As wrap up, where can our audience connect with you and learn more about you and what you're doing in the world?
Okay. So either at the Navitas Group website or on my LinkedIn profile.
Perfect.
Either way is good enough.
Awesome, Michael. We'll be sure to include the links to Navitas Consulting and your LinkedIn to the show notes. And the next episode, I'm really excited because we'll go beyond raising the money and talk about how to scale smarter. Because once you raise money, you want to make sure you scale and you build stronger teams. So thank you so much. We're going to deep dive into that next topic in the next episode.
Okay, very good.
Perfect. Guys, in the next episode, we'll go beyond raising money and talk about how to scale smarter, build stronger teams, and lead effectively after you've raised capital. So So stay tuned for that, and it's going to be packed with insights. We'll see you in the next one.
Thank you so much for taking the time to listen to this episode on Hacks and Hobbies. We absolutely appreciate your contribution. You can find additional notes on hacksandhobbies.com. Please share the podcast with your friends and tell them what you learned about our guest today.